I want to officially welcome everyone to today's internet seminar on incremental composite sampling designs for surface soil analyses. This is module one of a four-part module or seminar series. When you signed up for the first session or any part of this session, you would have been prompted to sign up for the other elements within the series. Again, there will be three other deliveries related to this training. Each one of the modules will be recorded and archived, so if you can't make one of the live deliveries, you can certainly replay them later on. If you realize you haven't signed up for the other four, you can find, or pardon me, the other three in this four-part series, you can find all of the seminar modules on the CLUIN training calendar. So remember, this is part one of a four-part seminar series. Again, my name is Jean Valance. I'm here in the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be helping to moderate today's seminar. We will begin the official presentation in just a moment, but while I'm waiting for a few other people to hop on the line, I'm going to cover some basic housekeeping items. For those of you who are new to CLUIN seminars, when you signed up for today's session, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage, which contained a complete description of the seminar series, including the topics that they'll cover today, a listing of our instructors, their contact information, as well as their bios, and then options to either download the seminar slides or actually load the seminar slides in a web browser window. So everyone should have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation open, either in a web browser window, printed out hard copy, or pulled up electronically on their computers. I'm going to ask everybody to move along from the first slide onto the next slide, which is slide number two. If you haven't accessed those slides, again, you can get it from the email reminders that went out on the seminar homepage. There are links to download the slides at the bottom, or you can follow the button that says Go to Seminar on the right, or pardon me, the left side of the screen. Again, I'm on slide number two. We have globally muted all of the phone lines because we do have a very large audience today. We will have designated breaks for Q&A, so those of you on the phone who want to ask a question out loud, at those designated breaks, I'll remind you, you can unmute by hitting #6. Until then, I ask that you remain on mute, so don't do anything until we get to the designated Q&A, and if and only if you have a question, you can unmute by hitting #6 to ask it. Those of you who are streaming audio online will be able to type up your questions or comments at any point in time. If you're looking at your slides in a web browser window, you'll see a series of orange icons located along the top of the slides. There's one that has a question mark button in it. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click that question mark button, a new window will pop up which will allow you to type in a comment or question. You can type those in at any point in time. We just will not address them until the designated period for Q&A that have been set up throughout today's presentation. So a reminder, those of you on the phones are globally muted. Please stay muted until we get to the Q&A breaks. Don't put the call on hold. If you need to hang up, you certainly may. You can dial back in without disrupting anything. Again, I'm on slide number two. Our presenters will be indicating as they move through the PowerPoint material, just as I've done, to let you know what slide number they're on. If you have them open electronically, you'll simply click on to the next slide. If you're looking at them in a web browser window, you can use the icons that appear at the top. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the left side of your screen. We will have 2 points in the section for designated Q&A, as well as some time at the end. So type those questions or comments up if you're looking at us electronically. Otherwise, you can keep them held by the phones until we get to the Q&A breaks. We are also recording this session. So if you found that this was helpful, if you think somebody else will benefit from it, if you're not able to participate in all the sessions, the recorded version will be up in about 1 to 2 weeks, and you will automatically receive an email once that recorded version is available for free download and replay. So if you can't make all four parts of the series, you can certainly take what you can live and then listen to the archived versions later on. And again, that's an automatic notification that will go out to everybody who registered to participate, even if you've been waitlisted. I think those are the final reminders that I have for today's session. So again, this is incremental composite sampling designs for surface soil analyses, module 1 and 4. And this is the first 2 hours of a one-day classroom course that's offered on incremental composite sampling, or ICS. The topics covered in module 1 will be an introduction, fundamental concepts underlying the ICS practices, terminology and existing guidance related to ICS. And our presenters will be Dina Crumbling, who works here in the EPA Superfund program, as well as Bob Johnson from Argonne National Laboratory. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, which is the official start of our presentation materials, and I'm going to turn things over to our presenters.
Hi, this is Dina Crumbling. Welcome, everyone. First, I want to say that I have violated every rule put out by the PowerPoint police in having slides that have way too much text on them. But from my perspective, I'd like to get handouts that have too much text on them because then I remember what they said and I don't have to scribble furiously to try to capture what's being said during the presentation. So if I offend anybody out there, I'm sorry. Also, for those who may have downloaded the slides already and are looking at them on your computer instead of online, some of the slides do have animations in them because these were taken from a classroom course. If it looks like a slide is blank for some reason, just click and click through the animations and everything will come up. Okay. Slide number 4 covers the overall webinar agenda. As was mentioned, this is a 4-part series. The dates that will be presented will be February 21st, 24th, and 27th for the remainder of this webinar, always at 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. On day 1, we're covering the fundamentals of soil sampling and technology and existing sources of information. On day 2, we're going to look at, delve into details about incremental and composite sampling designs, where we use the term incremental to indicate that we're looking for average concentrations over a decision unit, and we tend to use the word composite when we're talking about pooling samples for other purposes besides looking for an average concentration, for example, if we're looking for hotspots. Day 3 will cover the various calculations that are useful when you're working with these types of sampling plants. Day 3 and 4 will both have case studies of actual projects, and we'll have interspersed periods of Q&A. I think we already went through today's agenda, so let's get past slide 5 and go on to slide 6. The purpose of this webinar is to assist with the growing awareness out there about multi-increment or incremental or composite soil sampling designs, whatever term you want to use, and we will talk about the terms in a little bit. EPA has guidances for many years that is very clear that these types of designs are very useful, but the guidance from EPA has typically been lacking in a lot of implementation detail, so there's not been much adoption of these techniques, even though they are recommended by EPA. We find that other information sources, various parties and agencies are now filling the implementation detail gap that was left by EPA guidance. And especially this is true for the ITRC, the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, who has a team that has put out all the TechReg guidance, which just went live yesterday on its website. And we'll give you that web address later. It's actually on your links page. If you go back to your links page, there's a lot of documents that can be downloaded, and at the very top is a link to this brand new website that's all about incremental sampling. These designs can provide significant benefits, but we need to know how to apply them properly in order to reap those benefits. Slide 7. Your instructors for this series are myself, Robert Johnson from Argonne National Laboratory, and Michael Stroh, who's from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, will be presenting some case studies from actual projects that he has done. Missouri's been a real leader in trying out various designs and letting us know how they work so we can incorporate them into our training. Slide 9. We always have to do a disclaimer that references to products or service providers are for information purposes only and do not constitute endorsement. So I've done the disclaimer so the lawyers are happy. We are going to talk about two software programs. During the course of this webinar, one is called Visual Sample Plan and one is called ProUCL. We move to slide 10. This is a screenshot of the opening page to Visual Sample Plan, or VSP, as people are often familiar with it as. This is a tool that aids in planning a project. It helps figure out how many samples are needed using a statistical approach. Going to slide 11. This is a screenshot of the ProUCL opening page, where ProUCL is a data exploration and analysis tool. It's used for examining data after it comes back from the laboratory. Slide 12. Before we get too far along, let me cover in the introduction just some basic differences between incremental versus composite sampling, and these will be reiterated all along the way as we go through the webinar. But as I have mentioned briefly before, the goal of incremental sampling is to find an average concentration over some defined area, which is called a decision unit, or DU. Typically, three or more replicates will be collected in order to obtain a UCL, an upper confidence limit on the mean. On the other hand, usually the goal of composite sampling is to obtain information about the spatial distribution of contaminants. For the areas that are dealt with by compositing, generally an accurate or conservative estimate of the mean is not needed. Typically, composites do not use replicates over the same composite area. And a key feature of why to do composite sampling is to suppress short-scale heterogeneity, which can cause tremendous bias in our data results. And we'll find out more about that in the next presentation. Slide 13. So our key takeaway points from this webinar is that I hope you will come away with understanding that incremental and composite sampling designs both provide significant advantages for soil characterization. There are reasons for the different labels, and we'll discuss that later today. In order to have these strategies work, you have to match them closely to the project goals, and that requires systematic planning and using conceptual site models to get the design correct. Usually one of the objections we hear to incremental sampling or compositing is that you can't find hotspots with it. Well, actually you can. Using a combined strategy, you can find hotspots, but these hotspots have to be defined in terms of concentration and area. You can't find something if you don't know what you're looking for. So what is considered to be a hotspot has to be defined. And then we'll also talk about sample processing and correct subsampling. This is vital to data quality because all the work that you've done in the field to get representative samples can easily be lost when it comes to subsampling in the laboratory unless sufficient and appropriate sample processing has been done. So we move on to slide 14. We come to our next module, which is about fundamental concepts, where we need to talk about the nature of soil and how it interacts with contaminants and why soil is so difficult to analyze and get the same duplicate values for. So, Bob?
Thanks, Dina. The next 40 slides or so are going to focus on just some fundamental terminology and concepts that are important for the rest of this sequence of presentations. Slide 15. Soil sampling fundamentals, the things we're going to cover in this particular module include what are the goals typically that are associated with soil sampling programs, what questions are we trying to answer, what kinds of challenges we run into when we're sampling soils that make the interpretation of data particularly difficult, and then some basic statistical concepts that are important to understand that serve as the foundation for further discussions we're going to have about incremental sampling and composite sampling. So these three things are the things that I'm going to cover in the next 40 slides. Slide 16. Typical soil characterization goals. Usually when we're collecting soil samples, we're doing it for one of two reasons. We're either looking for the presence of contamination above some threshold that's been predefined, and typically when we're doing that, we're taking the results from individual samples and comparing them to some standard, or we're trying to determine the average concentration that applies over a particular area of interest. When we're looking for the presence of contamination above some threshold, we might be comparing it to background. We might be using something called a background threshold value. We might be comparing it to a never to exceed or not to exceed cleanup criteria that says, for example, all of our samples have to be below 400 parts per million for lead. Or we may be looking for hotspots, particular portions of a facility or a site where we believe contamination might be present and might be present over relatively small areas, but at concentrations that would be of concern. That's one potential objective or goal of soil sampling. The second is trying to estimate what the average concentration is over a particular area of interest. And later on we're going to be talking about decision units and sampling units, but for the moment let's just assume that we have a particular area that's of concern, perhaps it's someone's yard, and we'd like to know, maybe from a risk assessment perspective, what the exposure point concentration is for that yard. Typically here in the States we would be using an upper confidence limit on the mean being calculated from the various samples that were collected from the yard. Or we might be trying to get data that we can compare to an area average cleanup requirement. Again, using the lead example, perhaps our lead standard was 400 ppm averaged over someone's yard, and we wanted to confirm that, in fact, the yard on average was below that particular standard. Next slide, please, slide 17. So some basic concepts here. First of all, we're going to be using the word sample throughout the presentations, and we need to make a distinction between sample, as it's typically used in the statistical world, and when you hear the word sample in that context, we typically are referring to a set of data that are collected to try to characterize a population of interest, versus a sample the way we typically use it in the environmental arena, where we're talking about a physical thing that's been collected from biota or from water or from soil, which is the emphasis of this particular presentation, and then sending that sample off to the laboratory for analysis. So when we use the word sample, we're going to be using it in the context of the latter. We're going to be talking about something physical that was collected and then submitted for characterization purposes. The second point on this slide, sample support, is a term that you're going to find in EPA literature, but that's often not discussed in detail. But it's extremely important to the balance of the conversation we're going to have, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time with this. Sample support refers to the physical dimensions and characteristics of a physical sample. So, for example, if we're talking about sampling soil, if you pull a soil sample out of the ground, the sample support for that soil sample is basically the dimensions of the sample you just removed. If you used a 6-inch diameter coring tool and you pressed that coring tool 6 inches into the ground, well, that defines the sample support for the sample that was then extracted and sent off to the lab for analysis. It's a critical concept when we're talking about soil contamination and interpreting soil sample results that come back from the lab, because it turns out sample support often determines the concentration that you see coming back from the laboratory. And to illustrate that, I have a couple of additional slides here. If you could please go to slide 18. This is a schematic that we're going to use simply for discussion purposes. It's just to illustrate a concept. I'm not going to try to make it overly complex, but think of what you see here as a cross-section or view of the cross-section of a soil profile. So we've cut the ground away and we're looking at it from the side. That very top brown layer, consider that to be surface soil. And then what's underneath the brown layer, that brown layer, the lighter brown, consider that to be subsurface soil. And the question we're trying to answer, or the question that's been asked, is has surface soil been impacted by atmospheric deposition? So we're concerned that there might have been something deposited via the atmosphere onto surface soils that resulted in contamination above what we call it background levels. So let's just assume we know that the background concentration is in that light brown area. And the question is for the dark brown layer that sits on top of it, has it been impacted? Well, what might we do? If you could go to slide 19. One way of answering the question is to collect soil samples. And here in this slide, you see three different examples of samples that are being collected. In each case, a cross-section of the sampling profile. So in each case, think of each of those as being perhaps a cylindrical sampling tool that's being used, it's being pressed onto the soil surface, and then pulled back, extracting the soil sample. And so in each of these cases, I have three different samples that have different widths associated with them, or different diameters of the tool, and then that have been pressed into the soil surface to different depths. My question for you is, if I'm trying to answer whether the surface soil layer has been impacted, which of those three sample supports would be representative of the question that I'm trying to answer? And the answer to that question would be number one, because number one focuses on that contaminated, potentially contaminated soil surface, while number two and number three both include soils from the underlying deeper soil that are at background levels. Now, one might look at sample number one and say, well, yes, that's the best one of those three, but we could do better than that, and that would certainly be true. Perhaps sample number one should be extended through that whole layer, that whole brown layer, to be truly representative of that brown layer. But of those three options that we're providing you with right there, support number one would be the best one. Now, recall in the previous slide I said that sample support can determine what your concentrations are that come back from the lab. And hopefully this slide illustrates that. Suppose that surface layer was contaminated. Then clearly the sample that comes back from sample number two, which goes to significant depth and captures a lot of soil background, would probably be much lower value, much lower concentration than what we'd see from sample number one. And the results from sample number three probably would fall between the two. So in this particular case, three different sampling supports would result in three different estimates of the contaminant concentration that's present in our surface soil, driven strictly by the sample support that we choose to collect. Slide 20, please. I used the term representativeness in that previous slide, and so what exactly does that mean? Well, the formal definition of representativeness when we're talking about sampling is it's the degree to which our sample reflects the original population in one or more key characteristics that are of interest. And those key characteristics are defined by the context of the decision that we have to make. If you go to the EPA literature and in particular look at RCRA, there's a very specific definition that's associated with representativeness and it's reproduced there. Having a representative sample, having a representative soil sample, implies that the decision we're going to be making, in the process of making that decision, that we can confidently extrapolate concentration results from a relatively small sample mass back to a much larger soil mass, and the reason we can do that is because we believe that that relatively small subsample that was analyzed is somehow representative of the original mass of soil that we want to make a decision about. Next slide, please. Slide 21. You'll hear the term area of inference used in literature, and we'll be using it occasionally through the course of these presentations. It goes back to PCB guidance from the mid-80s. Area of inference is a concept that refers to that area of soil that a soil sample is representative of. If you look at the lower part of this slide to the left, if you had a grid of samples, the area of inference is kind of obvious. It would be, I mean, you, for each of that grid, you could carve it up into pieces, and that piece that surrounds a particular sample point could be considered an area of influence for that sample point. If you look to the right illustrates a compositing strategy. Here we have a series of black dots that all represent locations where soil is taken from, and then they're organized by color. And each time you have a set of colored blocks, all the same color, either yellow or blue, it identifies the fact that those samples are being combined into one composite. So here we have a compositing strategy where we have 9 separate sampling locations contributing to each composite. For each of those composites, the area of inference is actually the area represented by the 9 individual soil samples contributing to the composite. Next slide, please. Slide 22. When we have sampling programs that are laid out on a systematic grid, either rectangular or triangular, coming up with the area of inference for each of those samples is relatively simple and straightforward. When we have sites where samples are randomly distributed, or distributed in a biased kind of way, or in a judgmental kind of way, it's much more difficult to identify exactly what the area of inference should be for each of the samples that's collected. One way to do that is illustrated in this slide to the right, and that is basically the methodologies for drawing polygons or triangles around the polygons around sample points to try to capture their area of inference. As should be obvious from this slide, here we have samples that are not systematically laid out, and so our areas of inference vary greatly, both in size and shape, depending on where we are at this particular site and the distribution of samples in those particular areas. Next slide, please. Slide 23. A term that we use interchangeably with area of interest is the term sampling unit. And sampling unit has basically the same definition. It's that unit of soil that we intend a particular sample to represent. So, for example, if we had 10 individual samples that were taken from a particular area, call it area A, then, and let's just, for the sake of argument, say that those 10 samples were systematically laid out over that area, then that area A would have 10 sampling units associated with it, corresponding to the 10 samples. If, in addition to those 10 samples, we collected a field duplicate for QC purposes and had another co-located QC sample resulting in 12 samples sent off to the lab, we would still consider there to be only 10 sampling units for that area. If we only had one single sample taken from that area A, then the sampling unit for area A would be the whole area itself. Next slide, please. Slide 24. If, on the other hand, we collected 30 increments from our area, systematically distributed across the area, and combined them into one single composite for analysis, then area A would have just one sampling unit, and that sampling unit would be synonymous with area A itself. If we repeated that process 3 times and came up with a triplicate, or 3 replicate 30-increment composites taken from area A, there would still only be one sampling unit, and it would simply have 3 different samples that represented that same sampling unit. If, on the other hand, we divided area A into 4 adjacent but non-overlapping areas, as is illustrated in the bottom right of slide 24, and sampled each of those 4 independently, either with a discrete sample dropped into each, or by forming a composite from multiple increments collected from each, where we had 4 composite samples, one for each of the areas, then there would be 4 sampling units allocated to area A. Slide 25, please. In the upper left, how many sampling units in this particular case of discrete samples? Well, there'd be 12, because there were 12 discrete samples pulled, and that carves this particular area into those 12 rectangles that you see. In the lower right-hand side, there are 81 samples collected in all, but they're broken into groups of 9 to form composites. So how many sampling units do we have? Well, we have 9, representing each one of the composites that were formed from all those increments that were collected from this particular area. Key concept here, sampling units. If you have any questions about that, we'll come back to those. Be sure to ask them though at the end of the presentation. Slide 26. spatial scales of data variability. What is data variability? That's variations in a measured, in the measured magnitude of a population characteristic. In other words, suppose we're interested in lead concentrations, we send samples off to the laboratory, and we get those sample results back. The data variability associated with those samples would reflect the variations we see in the lead concentrations across our sample set. Now, where does data variability come from? Well, partly it comes from analytical errors from the laboratory, and we're not really going to be talking about those in these presentations per se. They're present, but typically they're small and inconsequential compared to some of the other sources of data variability that we're more concerned about. Data variability also comes from something called heterogeneity, and that is changes in the actual concentration present on a micro scale, on a macro scale, and in between. In other words, as you move very small distances across the sample or across the soil surface and we're able to accurately quantify what the concentration was at each of those locations, you'd find that it would vary significantly. And those variations are attributable to heterogeneity, and that heterogeneity drives data variability. The point of this slide is that we see that variability, we can see that kind of heterogeneity within samples themselves. That would be called microscale. That takes place within the size of a sample jar containing soil sample. Soil to be to analyze. Typically, we understand that that's there by measuring lab duplicates and watching for variability between those lab duplicate results. And you see some examples here of an original analysis and then a duplicate analysis. And as you can see, there are often significant differences among results coming back from exactly the same sample that simply reflect the variability that's present within the sample that's being subsampled. And just to make sure that we're all on the same page, since I'm sure people come from a variety of backgrounds, when we pull a soil sample out of the ground, be it 100 grams, 200 grams, 400 grams, whatever, and send it off to the laboratory, laboratories typically do not analyze that full soil mass. They will subsample it. They may take 1 gram, 5 grams, 10 grams. Point being, though, they take a very small amount of the original sample, and it's actually that small amount that then gets sampled itself. And so, if that original sample that was sent off to the lab was not thoroughly homogenized in some fashion, you would expect to see variability among subsample results taken from that sample. Next slide, please, slide 27. We can also see the effects of heterogeneity on a scale of a couple of feet among sampled locations. And what you're looking at here is some data that was generated by Jenkins back in the mid-90s. He was looking at soil TNT concentrations. You're looking at 7 sample results from a 2-foot radius sampling area. So this is very dense sampling. And the results are posted there alongside of each of the locations. And as you can see, those results range all the way from a low of 136 ppm to more than 30,000 ppm. So, over more than 2 orders of magnitude, basically, over a distance that's just a couple of feet separation. So, we have variability that happens within samples, but we have significant variability that happens between samples when those sample locations are very close together. And typically, in a real-world situation, if we had samples that were this close together, only 2 feet apart, we typically consider them as co-located samples. They were, in fact, representing the exact same area of influence, the same sampling unit. So I think the particular point that you get from this is, in this particular example, depending on which of these 7 locations you chose to sample, you might come to a very different conclusion about what the contamination status was of this particular location. Next slide, please, slide 28. Another example of short-scale heterogeneity, this tied to arsenic in a residential yard. Here I have 3 different yards, yard 1, yard 2, yard 3. Each of those colored dots for each of the yards is a location where arsenic soils were analyzed for arsenic, and their results are illustrated there. Yard 1, ranging over just 4 feet, the results go from 14 ppm to 129 ppm, over almost an order of magnitude. And we see similar kinds of things in yard 2 and yard 3. Again, exactly the same pattern as what we saw in the previous slide. The previous slide was TNT. This is arsenic. But the fact that we can have significant heterogeneity over a very small scale. Next slide, please. Slide 29. Another example, this is for uranium in surface soils. Again, here we have a very small sampling area. 5 samples taken from a 1 foot square area and analyzed. Here the values ranging from 49 ppm up to almost 500 ppm. Again, over an order of magnitude, over this small of a distance. The primary conclusion I'm trying to get you to draw is that last sentence on this slide. Simple chance in terms of where you collect your sample from a particular location can potentially lead to very different conclusions about what the contamination status is of that particular area. And that's all associated with heterogeneity. Slide 30. From the last scale, or the highest spatial scale of variability or heterogeneity, occurs typically over the order of what we might consider to be the size of a site, for example, somebody's yard, representing the patterns of contamination that are present at that facility or in that yard. And you see a schematic here to try to represent that. Here we have a house surrounded by its yard. The orange areas are areas that were impacted. The blue areas are areas that were not. And obviously one would expect significant differences between samples that were collected from outside the contaminated zones as compared to samples collected from inside the contaminated zones. This figure is a little bit misleading, though, because if you look at the figure, it would appear as though when you're in contamination, you are consistently in contamination, and it would give the sense that if we sampled within those brown or orange areas, that we would probably always get kind of the same result. But hopefully the previous slides would convince you of the fact that really it's more complicated than that, that while these might represent contamination footprints, in fact, if we looked closely in detail at the distribution of contaminants within those footprints, they could vary widely. And as a matter of fact, we might sample within a footprint and have that sample result come back and indicate that there wasn't any contamination present at all. And sample it again a couple feet over and find very high values. That's certainly plausible, and that's the way most sites actually operate, the way contamination's been laid down. Next slide, please, slide 31. So heterogeneity causes data variability. That heterogeneity can be present within samples. It can be present over very short scales between samples, basically samples that would be considered co-located. It can be present at larger scales, typically on the scale that we would usually see separating samples from facilities. Over all three scales, heterogeneity is present. And now just to kind of give you a sense, typically what we see within sample, if you think in terms of relative contributions to the overall variability that we would observe in results from a set of samples, the largest contributor is typically large scale. Behind that, close behind that, becomes short scale, and then behind that becomes within sample. And then finally, if you are concerned about analytical uncertainty, that's the smallest of those four. And although we typically spend a lot of time worrying about analytical uncertainty, in fact, that's the one we usually have to worry about the least in terms of making the wrong decisions based on our sample results. It's these other three sources of uncertainty that result from heterogeneity that really are the problem. All right, slide 32. Just a couple of slides here to talk about properties of soil matrices, and Dina may jump in here because she's more familiar with these slides than I am, so if I'm missing a point, Dina, feel free to interject. But just to kind of give you a backdrop of why that heterogeneity is actually there. Slide 33. If you were to zoom in on media that, you know, from a distance looked to be relatively uniform, and this is an example of that, you would find that, in fact, there was a fair amount of structure that was present, and that structure potentially would coincide to some portions of that matrix being uncontaminated or have relatively low levels of contamination versus other components of that matrix that were highly contaminated. So even if a soil matrix looks uniform, if you were to look at it closely under a microscope, you would probably draw a different conclusion. Slide 34. We sometimes talk about something called a nugget effect. And the nugget effect is the idea that within a sample mass, contamination is often carried by relatively small particles or nuggets that are highly contaminated, that are mixed in a matrix that in general has lower levels of impacts. Here we're looking at arsenic, and arsenic in this particular graphic is being carried by those portions that are lightly colored. And you see an iron hydroxide identified with a red arrow in here, and that particular iron hydroxide has a lot of arsenic associated with it. the point here is that if you're looking at individual particles, the arsenic concentration can be extremely high, even though the arsenic mass is relatively small. And that's because that arsenic is concentrated in nuggets or particulates that are associated with a sample. Next slide, please. Slide 35. If you were to look at clays, you would see similar kinds of things. Clays typically are composed of particles that have very small size, but that consist of layers. And they typically have very large surface areas to absorb contaminants against. That layering effect can create a nugget effect. If you go to the next slide, slide 36, an example of organic contaminants that get stuck between clay plates, and that leads to the kind of nugget effect that we were just talking about. Slide 37. You also see it in media that has a fair amount of organic matter. Contaminants are often associated with organic content that's contained in your soil matrix, and so again, that results in a nugget effect being present within samples. Next slide, please. Slide 38. There's been a lot of research done over the years that's clearly demonstrated that there actually is a very strong connection between particle size, or there often is a very strong connection between particle size and the concentration of contamination that's present and associated with those particular particle sizes. So here we're looking at lead. In my right-hand column, I have my lead concentration. In my left-hand column, my particle size. And as you can see, as the particle size shrinks, the concentration present in those particles increases dramatically. In this case, by more than two orders of magnitude. The belt average concentration here is around 1,000 ppm. But if I were to analyze individual particles, it could range all the way from 10 to almost 2,000 ppm, depending strictly on my particle size. Next slide, please. Slide 39. This connection between contamination being present and the amount of contamination and particle size is important from a representativeness perspective. Because we would want our subsample to be representative of the decision that we're trying to make. So for example, if we were trying to support a risk assessment and that risk assessment was based upon inhalation, so for inhalation concerns, we're concerned about small particulates that could be mobilized in the air, we might well focus on just that part of the sample that represented those smaller particle sizes. As opposed to a case where we're trying to make a disposal decision for some bulk material, and we don't care how that contaminant is distributed by particle size, we simply care about the average concentration that's present there, in which case particle size wouldn't be a factor, and we would try to segregate our sample by particle size. So again, exactly what our decision is drives what representativeness means, drives whether we need to be concerned about particle size. Particle size, though, and the issue of particulates and particulates carrying contamination is an issue for representative sampling in another way. And slide 40 is the slide I'm on now. This graphic tries to illustrate that. So here you have a container in the middle that has clean particles represented by the white circles versus contaminated particles, the black ones. And so we have a matrix here, a population that's predominantly clean, where the contamination is being carried by a relatively small number of particles. Clearly, if we take very small subsamples, we might miss our contamination altogether that's present in this media, as opposed to taking a larger subsample, which increases the possibility that we're going to be picking up contaminated particulate and understanding exactly what the concentration is in that sample. So on the left-hand side there, you can see an example of a very small subsample that shows very low concentrations because it missed the particulate, versus another subsample which might suggest your media was heavily contaminated because it happened to pick up a little bit of the particulate that was truly contaminated. The point here being, the last sentence in this slide, smaller subsamples are less likely to accurately represent the parent material than what larger samples are. Slide 41. Slide 41 tries to get at the same concept from a slightly different angle. Think now of taking our soil sample and flattening it, basically into two dimensions. And so consider four different situations here that are represented by this matrix. I have four different samples. They're all four contaminated in a different way, and I'm subsampling them potentially in a different way. So across the top of my matrix that I have here, I have high concentration samples versus low concentration samples. And then vertically, I have along the top row soil samples that are being subsampled with very small subsamples represented by the little red boxes you see in there, versus along in the bottom rows, samples that are being subsampled with relatively larger subsamples represented by the gray boxes. If you look at the upper right-hand corner, that blue box, you'll see that there are nine little red boxes in all, and of those nine, only two of them would have picked up a contaminated particle, and the other seven would have not, and one would have concluded that there wasn't contamination present in that particular sample. If you go to the other kitty corner to that, to the lower left-hand, you see in that particular case where we have larger subsamples and contamination more uniformly distributed throughout the soil matrix, every one of those subsamples picks up the contaminated particulate, and we would conclude that that sample had in fact been impacted. So when we have samples like the upper right-hand corner that have are really being driven by nugget effects and relatively sparse contaminated particulate within the sample, combined with very small subsamples, we run a high risk of getting sample results back that are really not representative of the original sample matrix. Slide 42, please. It's a good time, well, I don't know if it's ever a good time, but now it's as good a time as ever to introduce some statistical notions. And I'm going to start off by talking about data distributions. I have two here that I'm showing you. The one at the top is called an R distribution. Sometimes people also talk about it as a Gaussian or a bell-shaped curve. I have concentration along my x-axis in that graph. The probability of seeing a particular concentration is represented by the y-axis. I get a nice symmetric curve that's going there. It can actually, if it's a true normal distribution, go on forever to the right and go on forever to the left. In the bottom graph, I have what's called a log normal distribution. This one is more skewed to the right, so it's not a symmetric distribution. I can't have negative values in this particular case. Two different distributions that are often used to try to model the way we believe our sample results are behaving when we get them back from the laboratory. Next slide, please. Slide 43. It turns out that there is a fairly strong relationship between the size of our sample support and the distribution of results that we get back. And this slide tries to illustrate that. When we have very small sample supports with a large nugget effect, we will get very log normal distributions back from our data sets. On the other hand, when we have large sample supports from a media where the contaminants are fairly well distributed throughout that media, we'll get Gaussian curves. And so an example of the log normal is the red curve you're seeing. An example of a Gaussian distribution is the blue curve that you're seeing. So part of the point here that we're trying to convey is that our sample support has a direct impact not only on the lab values that we get back, we talked about it earlier, but on the distribution of lab values that we can expect to get back from a set of soil samples. Slide 44. Slide 44 tries to get at this from a slightly different direction. This is actually a study that was done quite a long time ago, about 30 years ago, and it was looking at americium 241 contamination in soils. So we had a large soil mass. The researcher here had a large soil mass, and he subsampled that soil mass in a couple of different ways. He subsampled it first by pulling out a bunch of 1-gram subsamples, and then 10-gram subsamples, and then 100-gram subsamples, and analyzing those. And then looking at the distribution of results associated with each subsample size. And that's what you see illustrated here in the graph. What you should note is that for 1-gram subsamples, you get a very log normal curve that's occurring, as opposed to the 100-gram, much larger subsample size, where our distribution of the lab results are much tighter and they're normally distributed. Another thing I want to point out here is if, in fact, we had, suppose, a never-to-exceed standard, or an action level illustrated by the red bar around three, a concentration of three. Depending on which subsample size you selected, you would probably draw a different conclusion about whether the original sample mass exceeded that standard or not. And in fact, if you used a 100-gram subsample size, you wouldn't have ever seen any of the results come back above 3. But if you had been using a 1-gram sample size, a bunch of the sample results would have come back 3. And that was strictly driven by the size of the subsample used to characterize the original sample mass in the laboratory. Next slide, please. Slide 45. Well, how is this relevant to our discussion about incremental and composite sampling? Well, some data here again from Jenkins tries to get at that. Here he had a site that was, or an area that was sampled 10 meter by 10 meter in size, so 100 square meters. He sampled it two different ways. He did it with discrete samples, 100 discrete samples taken from a systematic grid, a 1 meter systematic grid, so 100 discrete samples analyzed. And then he also created samples by doing composite sampling, or multi-increment sampling, where a number of, well, 30 increments were collected from that area, and that was done 10 times. 10 different multi-increment composite samples created, those analyzed from the laboratory. And what you see here are a comparison of the results that came back when he did that. If you drop down to the mean and look at the mean or the average result, you'll find for the discretes it was 1.1, but for the multi-increments it was 0.94. Very close together. Not much difference. But if you look at the min versus the max, you'll see that there's a dramatic difference between what was observed in the discrete samples versus what was observed in the multi-increment samples. The range was much tighter for the multi-increment samples than for the discrete samples. And also that the distribution of results down at the bottom for the discretes was skewed, but for multi-increment, it was Gaussian. It was bell-shaped. All right. So again, we're getting completely different distributions, driven strictly by the way we're sampling this particular area, discrete versus multi-increment. Slide 46. We can also introduce errors, subsampling just by the way we do our subsamples. For example, by scooping soil off the top of a sample jar without homogenizing the jar's contents first, recognizing that in fact, stratification often takes place when you ship a jar off to the laboratory and that jar gets shaken. Typically, large particles rise to the top, small fines drop to the bottom. Even the shape of the scoop we use to subsample jars can have an impact on biasing our results one way or the other. Slide 47. Historically, in this business, cleanup business anyway, our focus has been on trying to eliminate analytical uncertainty. And the result has been that we have laboratory results now that are typically very, very good with relative errors down in the low percent range. But the fact of the matter is, slide 48, if we're looking at decision quality and the possibility that we're making the wrong decisions, really that possibility is driven by the weakest link in our data quality chain. And only one of those links is our analytical uncertainty. There are other links. The number of samples we collect, how those samples are preserved, how they're subsampled, the method that's used then to analyze them. And the results that we end up with are only as good as the weakest link in that chain. Slide 49. I'm going to try to illustrate this. In fact, I have here some numbers that illustrate how uncertainties add. So let's just suppose that for a particular a decision that we're trying to make, we have two sources of uncertainty. We have our analytical error, and we have what we'll call sampling error. And sampling error really captures the effects of heterogeneity that we were talking about. And it turns out that those two errors add via Pythagorean theorem. In other words, as their squares. And what that simply means is that the total error is dominated by the larger of the two contributing errors, analytical error versus sampling error. And typically for sites, it's sampling error that completely dominates our analytical error. And we can do a significant amount of work to reduce our analytical error and have very little effect on our overall total error if we don't address sampling error as well. Next slide, please. Slide 50. So how do we reduce data uncertainty? Well, if we have significant problems with analytical errors, we might modify the analytical technique. We might improve our QC. For subsampling errors, when we have within-sample heterogeneity, the only way to deal with that is to improve our sample prep. That means better homogenization, larger subsamples, perhaps an incremental approach to the way that sample mass is subsampled for analysis. When we're talking about errors that result from low sampling density in the field, there's really only one way to address that, and that's simply to collect more samples from more locations. Next slide, please. Slide 51. Quickly cover some statistical terms. Mean, it's the population average that we would observe over an area of interest. The median, that's that result where half our population is below it and half of it is above. The range is the difference between the min and the max. The variance is a measure of the spread of values that we would expect to see coming back from our laboratory. Next slide, please, slide 52. Standard deviation is the square root of the variance. Again, another measure of the amount of variability that's present. Coefficient of variation is the ratio of our standard deviation to the mean, and it's a measure of our relative variability. Skewness, the degree to which our data sets are symmetric in their distribution versus being pulled off to one side like a log normal distribution might be. And then a confidence interval, it's a range of values that tries to capture the uncertainty associated with a point estimate like a mean. So we might talk about building 95 or constructing 95% confidence intervals around the mean. You'll often hear that. Next slide, slide 53. Typically, when we're talking about confidence limits, we talk about the 95% level by default, but one can use others. But the idea, again, if we're talking about estimating average concentrations, is if you develop 95% UCLs, those 95% UCLs define a confidence interval, the idea being that our true mean should fall within that confidence interval. Or another way of saying it, that confidence interval should capture the true mean 95% of the time. The size of that confidence interval is dictated by how confident we want it to be, the variability that's present in the data set used to estimate the mean, the assumptions that we're making about the underlying data distribution, was it normal, was it log normal, and then the number of data points that we have for contributing to the mean. All those things affect how wide that confidence interval is around the mean. Now really what we'd like to have is for decision-making purposes, we'd like to have confidence intervals that are very tight around the mean, indicating that we're confident. We're pretty confident. We know exactly what that concentration is. And that's one of the reasons why we're going to be talking about incremental sampling here. It's because that allows us to do that. Slide 54, just some mismatch between statistics and environmental sampling. When we're sampling people, it's very clear what our sampling unit is. It's a person. But when we're talking about soils, the sampling unit is driven or defined by the way we're doing our soil sampling and can vary from one soil sampling program to another. Also, traditionally in statistics, for environmental statistics, we don't necessarily consider spatial relationships, but really for contamination, those relationships are important. Slide 55, decision unit. Decision unit is that volume of soil or set of objects that we want to treat as a single thing from a decision-making perspective. So we're going to collect a bunch of samples from a decision unit and make a decision about that decision unit. Decision units can be broken up into multiple sampling units or areas of inference. The population is that set of objects or material volumes that share a common characteristic. It can be synonymous with decision unit, but it doesn't have to be. We're also going to be talking about decision units throughout the balance of the presentations. Slide 56. A pictorial example of a site broken into decision units. And the main thing here to take away from this, is you see various decision units labeled there, you'll notice that their sizes are different. And their sizes are different because these decision units are serving different purposes, depending on where you are at the site. Some of the larger ones are being used to support risk assessment decisions. Some of the smaller ones, highlighted or outlined in purple, are small because they're trying to support remediation decisions. We already know we have contamination there that needs to be addressed, and we're trying to get a better handle on its spatial distribution and how remediation should take place. So but the point is we're making a decision about each of those areas, and that's why they're called decision units. Slide 57, and I believe this is the last slide in this section, if there's one thing that you take away from what I just presented, it's that when we're making decisions and we're making mistakes in making decisions. The reason why is heterogeneity. Heterogeneity rules in this business. And what we need to find is a way of conducting sampling programs so that we minimize the effects that heterogeneity has on our decision making. And multi-increment and composite sampling is one very cost-efficient approach for doing that. That's it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Bob. Before we go ahead, I just want to take a quick break for some questions. And I also want to comment, I know a number of individuals who were streaming the audio online experienced some disruptions as well as some problems with the continuous stream. We think we fixed that a while ago. However, for some people, it may have been disruptive enough that they missed a large chunk of the presentation. The entire session, though, has been and is continuing to be successfully recorded. So if you did have audio problems, we've emailed everybody, but please know that the archive is going to be available in complete form with no skips or audio disruptions, and we're going to make that a priority to get that out within a day or so. So you should have an email with a link to replay the whole thing very, very shortly, and we apologize for that inconvenience. I know a number of people may have already popped off on streaming simulcast, but this is a reminder. If you are online or looking at the slides through a web browser window, you can electronically submit comments or questions by using that question mark button and typing that up. But until I see any of those of you on the phones, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. You can hit #6 right now, and we'd ask that you identify either yourself or your organization, and feel free to ask a question or make a comment verbally. Again, it's #6 to take yourself off of mute, and then feel free to ask a question if you're on the phone. Okay, well then in the interest of time, I'm going to let our speakers carry on. I'm going to have everybody move along. We're on slide number 58. And again, if you're streaming the audio or looking at the slides online, you can type up your comments or questions at any time. And when we get to the next question break, I'll read them out loud on your behalf. Gina?
Okay, module 1.3, talking about terminology and existing guidance. Slide 59. So why all these different words? We have multi-increment sampling, or MIS. We have incremental sampling methodology, ISM, composite sampling, and then ICS for incremental composite sampling. Why all these different labels? We go to slide 60. Well, the term compositing or composite sampling has been used since 1985 by EPA guidance. It conveys the idea of pooling increments to form a larger sample. The multi-increment sampling term was a term that was coined by Chuck Ramsey, and he trademarked it as MIS. So when ITRC began putting a team together to look at incremental sampling, their lawyers were concerned about using a term that was trademarked. So they needed to come up with another term, so they came up with ISM, or incremental sampling methodology. And now we're using the term also incremental composite sampling. The incremental sampling methodology really only focuses on getting an average and less on using composites to perform other goals. So we're making ICS an EPA term that combines the ITRC's ISM features with features from EPA's existing compositing guidance. And so we can have goals that include more than just looking to get the average over a decision unit. So there are reasons for all these terms, and I apologize for confusion that may be caused, but if we go on to slide 61, we see that they really all share common characteristics. They all refer to collecting soil samples from various physical locations. These are called increments. I sometimes hear people use the term aliquot, which isn't technically correct. An aliquot is something that comes out of a larger sample, whereas an increment is something that goes in to make a larger sample. Another common characteristic, then, is pooling these increments to form one sample that must be well homogenized. We have just gone through Bob's presentation showing the extreme heterogeneity of soils at many different physical scales. And the only way to get confident, reliable results is if samples are processed in a way that smooths out that heterogeneity so that we are truly getting a concentration that is representative of the entire sample and not just representative of the 1 gram that might be analyzed. Another common characteristic lies in their purpose. The primary difference, as I've mentioned, lies in the purpose, which is an incremental sampling. As ITRC is using it, they're really looking for an average over a decision unit versus searching for hotspots, which can be done by compositing techniques. And then MIS, or multi-increment sampling, evolved from a lot of work that the Corps of Engineers did on trying to optimize sampling designs to get reliable results for explosives residues on firing ranges. But as research has gone on, we can generalize the information gathered from MIS and their procedures to work on other analytes as well, not just explosives. On to slide 62. And when it comes to it, all soil samples are composites. The difference is at the spatial scale at which it occurs. If you pull a core and you take a segment of that core to put in a jar, they're composites. It's a grouping of many separate individual particles that form a whole. Even a pinch of soil that's taken from a jar is a composite. For example, you could take a soil jar and open it and take a scoop off the top, but if you shook up the jar and then scooped, you'd get a completely different sample made of different particles that were rearranged. If we go on to slide 63. So let's go into more of these basic differences between incremental and composite sampling. So I said the goal of incremental sampling is to estimate the average concentration over some defined area or volume of soil, which is called a decision unit. And it's called a decision unit because it's an area or volume for which a specific decision is being made, whether it's a remediation decision or an exposure decision and risk assessment. Those are very common decision units. One of the things we can do with incremental sampling is take 3 or more independent replicates, and it allows us to calculate an upper confidence limit on the mean of those replicates. And that provides input that risk assessors often need in order to do the risk assessments. They need that UCL. Going on to page 64, this graphically shows what I've been talking about. On slide 64, we see the layout for an incremental sample. This one happens to have, I believe, 30 increments. The placement of the increments is randomized by choosing a starting point at random, and then at regular intervals, other samples are taken with the reference to that random sample. So go on to slide 65. This illustrates replicate incremental samples. So independently, three incremental samples are and sampling locations are laid out and collected individually. On to slide 66. So a goal of composite sampling is to gain information about contaminant spatial distributions. Generally, the conservative estimate of the concentration mean is not needed, and we typically use the term sampling unit to refer to the area covered by the composite, and that's generally smaller than a decision unit and may be part of a decision unit. In composite samples, replicates, like we just saw for the incremental samples, these kinds of replicates are typically not used for composites. But what composites do for us is improve the representativeness of single samples by suppressing that short-scale heterogeneity that Bob talked about in his presentation. And also, typically, composites use fewer increments per sample than incremental sampling. If you go on to slide 67. Now, stick with me as I work through this slide. It looks complex. It follows a figure. Remember that a sampling unit is a volume of soil that's represented by a single sample. This is an example of tiered compositing. If this was done as a straight incremental sample, the sampling points represent 32 increments. And if we were doing a straight incremental sample, those 32 increments would be combined together all at once. But we're going to throw in a twist. The decision unit is split up into four sampling units of equal volume. Each of those sampling units contains 8 of the 32 increments. The 8 increments for each sampling unit is initially composited together to form a composite for each sampling unit. And that's pictured there with the red, green, brown, and blue square blocks coming out of the sampling units. Next, what you do is each of these four sampling unit composites are processed so they are as homogeneous as possible. Then a portion of the sampling unit composite is taken out. And that's represented by the little ball coming out of the squares, out of the colored squares. Those portions are then combined to form an incremental sample that represents the whole decision unit, because all 32 sampling locations are represented within that final incremental sample. Now, why would we do this? Well, what's done is the rest of the sampling unit composites are archived for the time being. And then that overall incremental sample is analyzed. If that sample fails a test for exceedance of an action level, for example, so that we would say that the decision unit is dirty. The next step is, well, how would we clean it up? Do we have to clean up the entire decision unit, or can we narrow down what areas might be more contaminated than others so that we could only focus on the contaminated areas and not have to clean up the whole BU if it's not needed? So what we can do then is go back to the SCU composites that had been archived and analyze those four to find out where in the DU the contamination lies. and that way we can optimize our remediation goals. So if the sample, if the decision unit is dirty, you end up with 5 analyses. If the decision unit comes back as clean, you don't need to go back and analyze the archived SU composites. You've gotten away with only a single incremental sample. Now again, though, if you want to calculate a UCL on the incremental sample, you need to have 3 of these 32 increment layouts. You wouldn't have to do the splitting into SU composites each time because, again, you don't need an accurate estimate of the mean for those. You just need an indication of where the location within the DU where the soil is the hottest. Go on to slide 68. There are certain requirements that are common to these processes, whether you call it MIS, ISM, or ICS, which is you must do the upfront systematic planning. You must be willing to invest in that because if you don't do that right, everything else will fall apart. When you're doing your systematic planning, you need to involve the sampling crew who's going to be taking the samples. You want to involve the laboratory if at all possible, especially if they are going to be responsible for processing the samples. And you should involve the data user, such as the risk assessor, so that they can provide input into the design to make sure it's going to meet their data needs. QAPs, quality assurance project plans, have to discuss the rationale for choosing the decision unit for its size, for its locations, and for the number of increments that you're going to use for the decision unit. The QAP also has to give detailed procedures for how samples should be collected in the field. In this webinar, we're not going to spend a lot of time on discussing field sample collection because we can go now to the ITRC ISM document on the web, and they have an excellent discussion in there. Field sample collection options. The lab has to get detailed instructions for sample processing. Are they going to be required to split the sample or sieve it, grind it? Is there a target particle size that they need to be aware of that's maybe a exposure pathway for the risk assessment? Are they going to be doing incremental subsampling? It's a very good idea for them to do that. We'll see about that later. But they need to be given a heads up, make sure that they have the right equipment and know how to do it. And what's the mass of the analytical subsample? Are we going to try to increase the mass from what they're used to? They may be used to doing 1 gram of soil for metals analysis. And maybe the mass needs to be increased to 2 grams or 5 grams. And that needs to be discussed with the laboratory to make sure that they are able to handle that. Is the decision going to be based on a simple incremental sample result, which is the average for the decision unit, or is it going to be based on an upper confidence limit on the average? And what about quality control for the incremental composite process? Where are we going to do replication? And we'll cover QC on day 2. Going on to slide 69. There's actually a long history of EPA guidance concerning compositing. Six documents that I've been able to find go into some depth. They start in 1985 with PCB guidance, And the most recent guidance from EPA concerning incremental sampling is from the SW846 method. In Appendix A, they discuss incremental sampling as a way to deal with the extreme heterogeneity that you find at military ranges. We'll talk about that in a bit. On to slide 70. So this is the web page with the URL where you can find guidance concerning compositing with PCB characterization. On to slide 71. As Bob talked about, one of the strategies that the PCB instructions provide is compositing just for general characterization, and that is done using groups of 9 increments. On the other hand, another design that they offer is for characterizing point sources and finding the delineating where the edge of the contamination is. And that can be done with compositing according to the PCB guidance. I've heard quite a number of times people say that the TSCA guidance for PCBs does not allow compositing, and I hope this shows that that's not true. On to slide 72. Another document dealing with compositing was from 1995. This came out of the Quality Assurance Division, part of EPA. Again, the URL is provided if you want to download that document. On to slide 73. It was interesting what was said in this document. Back in 1995, EPA thought that compositing was the next greatest thing and that it would catch on and everybody would adopt it. That didn't happen. But what's stated in the guidance is that they felt that composite sampling was quite acceptable for establishing and verifying attainment of cleanup standards for screening material for contaminants, and for devising confidence limits on proportions. Slide 74. This document also reported out on the simulation that was performed from data that was collected for PCBs. And if you're interested, I'll leave you to read the whole case study. But the bottom line was that their results showed that compositing provided an unbiased estimate of the mean and variance, and it could be done so with only 1/4 of the number of analyses that was in the original study. So the original study with the actual data used 360 samples, but their simulation showed that actually if they used a compositing strategy, they could have gotten away with only 90 analyses. Well, what about hot spots? If you go on to slide 75, the same guidance talks about finding hot spots. If they added 8 analyses, they would not to the 90 that they already had for determining the mean and variance. An additional 8 analyses could be used to find the highest hotspot in the area. A total of 110 analyses would find the mean, the variance, plus the 4 highest hotspots. So certainly EPA has a long history of guidance that explains that compositing can be used to find hotspots. Slide 76. The RCRA waste sampling draft technical guidance was put out by the folks who put out the SW846 analytical manual. This document was an expansion of what used to be Chapter 9 in the RCRA manual, in the SW846 manual, but it was expanded and put out then as its own standalone guidance. This is a very, very good guidance. I would highly recommend that anybody wanting to understand these issues take a look at this guidance. It's very well written and easy to understand. If we go on to slide 77, this is a screenshot of a table of contents. You can see there in the boxed part that section 5.3 is all about composite sampling, about various designs. 5.3.5 is using composite sampling to obtain a more precise estimate of the mean. And right after that is a section about using composite sampling to locate hotspots. On to slide 78. I want to point out that this document, this RCRA sampling guidance, does a really good job explaining the G theory for sampling particulate materials. Due to time constraints, we're not going to go into discussing G theory in this webinar, but it's a fundamental basis for the procedures that are used in incremental sampling, and it's very accessible to understand if you read it through the RCRA sampling guidance. It's described very well in very down-to-earth language and very easy to understand. Page 79, another sampling guidance put out by EPA. This is part of the QA series called QAG5S. S stands for sampling. They have 36 pages of text and appendices dealing with composite sampling. Slide 80. Again, you'll see a recurring theme here. Section 10.2 is using composite sampling for estimating a mean. 10.3, you can estimate a population proportion. We will not go into that in this webinar. Slide 81. And section 11.1, composite sampling for identifying a trait. We're not going to look at that one either. But section 11.2, compositing for identifying extreme sampling units, or in other words, hotspots, is something we're going to discuss. On to slide 82. Going to look at a couple designs and compare and contrast them. On the left, we have an incremental averaging design where we have 30 or more increments laid out across a decision unit, and a composite sample or an incremental sample from those increments is formed for analysis, and so you have one analysis that covers that entire decision unit. On the other side of the slide, on the right-hand side, there's a composite searching strategy that can be used if you're trying to clear a large area. Say you have big agricultural fields or pastures, and they need to be cleared to prove that they're not contaminated by some contaminant or other. Well, these separate decision units can be bundled. And in this example, we see six that are put together. The composite can be formed from a sample from each of the six. and then that sample is analyzed. Now there's a certain mathematical way that this data has to be interpreted, and that's going to be covered on day two. But wanted to show you that compositing and incremental sampling can be used a number of different ways. On to slide 83. And you saw this slide already before, this figure. And you might be thinking that composite searching is very similar to what was covered before. So there's similarities between the slide that you're, between the figure that you're seeing on slide 83 and the figure that we saw on slide 82. But there's a slight difference in that in slide 82 we were trying to clear a large area. So we were grouping decision units together, and each decision unit would be sampled with a multi-increment sample that would then be split and added to incremental samples from other decision units to form a composite. Whereas in the composite searching that we saw with a single decision unit, there the sampling units were subdivisions of the decision unit. We're only looking at one decision unit, and our purpose is to preserve spatial information in case we have to go back and clean up that decision unit. Slide 84. Now we're continuing on here with EPA guidance concerning incremental sampling. This is from the SW846 method 8330B, which is an analytical method for explosive residues in soil by HPLC. And Appendix A, as I mentioned before, deals with the collection, processing of representative samples from military ranges. This guidance from SW846 is very important. It's a basis of experiments and more research that's been involved in developing incremental approaches to collecting samples and then drying, sieving, and grinding them in order to process the sample so that we reduce the subsampling variability in the laboratory. This method really set the standard for subsequent work on other analytes. Slide 85. So what about risk assessment? One of the most common objections to incremental sampling or compositing is that risk assessors can't use the data. So I'd like to go through some select parts of risk assessment guidance to see what it actually says. Slide 86. So what does RAGS and the risk assessment guidance of 1989 say? Well, if you can see by the yellow highlighting there, that composite samples generally may not be used to assess the presence or absence of contamination. However, they may be used in risk assessment only to represent average concentrations and thus exposures at a site. For example, hotspots cannot be determined using composite samples. So one point of this quote is that exactly what we're doing with incremental sampling is what the RAGS guidance says can be done in order to support risk assessment. At the time that this RAGS guidance was written, the guidance from EPA about finding hotspots with composite samples wasn't out yet. So that's why they made that statement that hotspots cannot be determined using composite samples, which is not true any longer. On to slide 87, this is some more risk assessment guidance from May 1992, slide 88. Have you ever wondered why we use the UCL as the average concentration? It's worthwhile to point out, although the upper confidence limit concept was mentioned in Bob's presentation, that the upper confidence limit is an estimate of the mean. It's an estimate of the average. It's a conservative estimate, but it represents the average. And here in this guidance, it explains why they went to using the 95% UCL instead of just the arithmetic mean. It says that the 95% UCL accounts for uncertainties due to limited sampling data at Superfund sites. As sampling data becomes less limited at a site, uncertainties decrease. The UCL moves closer to the true mean, and exposure evaluations using either the mean or the UCL produce similar results. Well, the goal of incremental sampling is to increase sample density and provide a confident estimate of the mean at an affordable cost. Slide 89. Just a point about the question, can another value other than the 95% UCL be used? And it says yes, if the risk assessor can document that high coverage of the true population mean occurs. In other words, that the value that the risk assessor is using equals or exceeds the true population mean with high probability. And statistical simulations have shown that the UCL calculated from replicate incremental samples can provide high coverage of the true population mean. And so it meets this goal even if they only have three data points. On to slide 90. As far as the newer risk assessment guidance from EPA, the RAGS, Part D from 2001, if we go on to slide 91, there's really only one mention of composite sampling at all. It's on page 2-3 where it says, the SAP should be accompanied by detailed sampling maps showing the location and type of samples, for example, grab, composite, or duplicate. So it mentions composite in a way that is implies acceptance that composites could be used as long as it's documented how they should be used so they're used correctly. Another risk assessment guidance on calculating UCLs. On slide 92, there's the title and the URL, and on slide 93, it also emphasizes that the UCL is an estimate of the average, and it is the average concentration that is what's supposed to be used to estimate the exposure in an exposure unit at a site. Go on to slide 94. Hopefully some of you are familiar with the soil screening guidance, the technical background document that went with it. This is from 1996. It also discusses compositing on pages 81 to 132. Go on to slide 95. On page 89, there's a noteworthy quote that hopefully will hearken you back to Bob's presentation. It says, note that the size, shape, and orientation of sampling volume, i.e. support, for heterogeneous media have a significant effect on reported measurement values. For instance, particle size has a varying effect on the transport and fate of contaminants in the environment and on potential receptors. So the term sample support is not new. We did not create it. It's been around for a long time, and it's been in a number of EPA guidances. explaining that the concept and the way that we handle samples so that we take sample support into account is very important because it determines what measurement values we get back on our data. Moving on to slide 96. Again, from the soil screening guidance, pages 89 and 90, it discusses compositing. It says, because the objective of surface soil screening is to ensure that the mean contaminant concentration does not exceed the screening level, the physical averaging that occurs during compositing is consistent with the intended use of the data. So again, EPA guidance accepting of compositing. If you go to slide 97, we can go on to other sources of information about compositing. There is an ASTM manual, and the information about that document is provided here. On to slide 98, as I mentioned, the ITRC now has an incremental sampling guidance that went live on the web yesterday. These slides had to be loaded up onto the website before then, so I didn't have the website at that point, so that's why it's on the slide as to be announced. But it is on your links page, and I'm sure if you do an internet search for ITRC-ISM, you will find it immediately. Then on slide 99, there's other recent guidance documents regarding incremental sampling. There is state guidance that Hawaii has put out that's quite extensive. There's guidance put out by the state of Alaska. And then there's documents that the Army Corps of Engineers put out from the research that they did at their firing ranges and military ranges when they were exploring the use of incremental sampling and testing it. Slide 100. You can't emphasize too much that project planning is key to making these designs work. They have to be well formulated. A lot of discussion up front. We've only shown you a few of the options that are available to design incremental compositing sampling designs. So working together with your risk assessors and other data users is critical to making sure that the data will be accepted once you have generated it. Also cannot emphasize enough that sample processing and subsampling is critical to maintaining data quality. The sample processing can begin in the field. Sieving can be done in the field. Disaggregation can be done in the field if the soil is already dry, or at least mostly dry. Or all of the processing can be done in the laboratory. It's really a matter of negotiation and the specifics of your project. But the goal is to maintain that chain of sample representativeness for each step along the way of processing the sample, right through subsampling in the laboratory. And we'll cover more of this subsampling in the laboratory on day 2. Slide 101. This is a graph from the ASTM document that we talked about. It shows how much variability you can get when your sample size, in other words, the mass of your analytical sample, is too small to deal with the size of your particles. So if you look at where I have the line drawn, the 2-millimeter particle size, that's equivalent to a 10-mesh sieve. And 2 millimeters is usually where most soil scientists consider soil to be, so that everything larger than 2 millimeters can be taken out and considered non-soil, and then everything below 2 millimeters can be considered as part of the soil. So at that, what that line means, that two, if you follow the blue line, your variability is almost 50% if you're only using 1 gram of soil and your particle size is up to 2 millimeters. Now that's really important for metals analysis, because most metals analysis is done on sample masses between 0.5 gram and usually 1 gram, maybe 2 grams at the most. Just the fact that the analysis is done on non-sieved soils introduces a tremendous amount of variability simply because of the effects of particle size. That's not even accounting for all the other sources of heterogeneity and variability in the sample. On to slide 102. This just gives a summary of things that need to be done during sample processing. The kind of processing depends on the type of soil and how much moisture. In general, it's going to involve drying either in a low-temperature oven or air drying. Disaggregation, which means you need to break up the clods of dirt. Sieving, you want to find out if you have a particular particle size fraction of interest. For example, a risk assessor may be interested in the dust particle size because that's the exposure route. Well, you need to do sieving in order to get out that particle size that they're interested in. Another reason why communicating with your risk assessor is so important. Grinding and milling. This has some controversy associated with it, and we'll discuss it more on day two. And I give another plug for the ITRC document. They have a lot of really good information concerning sample processing and the various options for performing these procedures. On to slide 103. This is another excellent guidance put out by EPA that nobody has seen. It's probably one of their best unknown guidances. It's guidance for obtaining representative laboratory analytical subsamples from particulate laboratory samples. On to slide 104. One of the things it talks about is incorrect versus correct subsampling. Now, this is a G concept, but it emphasizes that tools have to be structured so that they do not discriminate against certain particle sizes or certain parts of the sample. So hopefully you can see from the diagram that an incorrect tool, which is this curved scoop-like utensil, it collects more from the top of the layer than from the bottom of the layer, and that makes it an incorrect tool for subsampling. A correct tool collects equally from both, so the preferred subsampling tool is one that is shaped as it is seen there, with square sides on a square bottom. Slide 105. When you're doing subsampling, there's also a recommended mouth size. They recommend that for 2 millimeter particles, a mouth of 16 millimeters is recommended when you're doing the subsampling in order to prepare the analytical sample. Slide 106. This is just a photograph that show how incremental sample reduction works. And this is discussed quite a lot in the subsampling guidance. Slide 107 shows an example of doing incremental subsampling On the left side, it's subsampling from a core that's been laid out in a pan to get a sample that's being sent to the lab. And then on the right, it's incremental subsampling in order to get the analytical subsample that will be digested and then analyzed. Slide 108. I took this from that subsampling guidance because one of the techniques that people often use to quote-unquote homogenize samples is coning and quartering. But from the experiments that were done as the basis of preparing the subsampling guidance, they found out that it really didn't work very well and it's not recommended. On to slide 109, this is the end of our presentation for day one. Thank you for staying with us, and there'll be a lot more coming in the next three sessions.
Great. Thank you, Dina. At this point, we're going to take some questions, and we may kill a few minutes past our scheduled end time of 4 p.m. to try to accommodate these because they do look pretty technical. I'm going to start with the questions that have been submitted online, again, in the interest of time. If you are listening or looking at the slides through a web browser, you can continue to type up your comments and questions, and whatever we can't get through today, I will make sure to pass on to our instructors and have them follow up with you after the session today. I'm going to start with our first question. This came in right before or right as the Bob's part was ending and your part was beginning, so I think this question may be related to Bob, but you guys both may answer. And the first one's coming in from Honolulu, Aloha, and they ask, what factors should be considered in setting the size of a decision unit? If a decision unit is too large, for example, implementing any necessary remedies over such a large area may be impossible or prohibitively expensive without additional sampling.
You're right. A lot of factors go into considering the size of the decision unit. Risk assessment is usually one of the biggest factors that's considered. You know, what are the receptors and what exposure area does the risk assessor consider to be relevant for the exposure? And that might be large in some circumstances, but in most circumstances it's fairly small. Especially when you're dealing with residential areas where the size of a residential yard is usually between a quarter and a half acre. But just taking into account the risk aspect as well as the cleanup aspect, as was shown in the figure that Bob showed with the smaller decision units being used for remedial design, so that you were more able to surgically remove the most contaminated material and not remove the clean material along with the dirty.
Okay.
Bob, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, the other thing, only other thing I would add is that as a site or an area progresses through the cleanup process, it usually becomes more obvious what decision units would be appropriate. When one's early in the process, particularly if one's dealing with a large site or large area that's potentially contaminated, there may not be very much information at all to indicate what would be a reasonable size for decision units and how they should be laid out. And typically in that part of the process, sampling often takes the form of judgmental or biased sampling that tries to cost-effectively target areas that are highest at risk for contaminants being present to identify whether they're there or not. Usually as one progresses through a site and gets into the actual risk assessment phase, then as Dina alluded to, it becomes more of a risk assessment decision about what an appropriate exposure area would be and so what how should the site be carved up into the correct kinds of decision units. The other thing to say about that is obviously once you lay a decision unit out on the ground, you run the risk of splitting a contaminated area in half. If, you know, where it's partly in one decision unit, partly in the other, and if you had only put the decision unit right over that contaminated area, you would have identified it, and you would have failed whatever criteria was in place. Again, as one goes through here, there's nothing locked in stone about decision units, and decision units are used for a variety of purposes, and it may be as your data comes back, you decide that you have to revisit the way you've laid out decision units across your site to accommodate new information that's coming into play.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to jump to another question that was submitted online. We've actually had a few come in related to VOCs or volatiles. The first question simply wants to know if you guys will be touching on incremental sampling for volatile or semi-volatile contaminants during the series.
No. Again, it's a time constraint, and also because you can find terrific information about it in the ITRC document. And reading that is better than anything we could provide in the short amount of time that we have.
Okay. And then related to that, someone wanted to know in reference to slide number 61, when you were talking about homogenizing the sample, you wouldn't want to homogenize a sample if it was a VOC.
Right, exactly. Sorry if I missed saying that.
Okay. Our next question is coming in from Dallas, Texas, and they ask, should we expect COC or contaminant of concern distributions to be Gaussian, or would we expect particular COCs to be distributed, skewed, assuming that the sampling area is not too large?
That's an interesting question. And I think one of the things, hopefully, that you're going to take away from this is that if you use an incremental sampling approach, the distribution of your results will often appear to be Gaussian, which is a good thing, because it makes your statistics work better, and you'll get results that are probably more representative of what the true average is if you're after an average value. If you're working with discrete samples, though, and you're looking at results from a site where there have been impacts historically, you would not expect your results to be Gaussian. You would expect them to be skewed to the right, and that's pretty typical. Even background distributions, typically, if you had enough samples and you were to run a statistical test to determine whether the results were normally distributed or not, you would probably reject it. Because the fact is even normal distributions don't truly represent the way background conditions often appear, because normal distributions go off in either direction, can assume you could have negative values, which in fact you know is not the case, and assume you can have really large values, which in fact is not the case. So in general, if you're talking about discrete samples, you would expect to have some kind of skewed distribution in play.
Great, thank you. The next question is regarding slide number 76. They'd like to know if there's a final version of the draft August 2002 RECRA race sampling guidance that's available. Slide number 76, you reference a draft August 2002 RECRA waste sampling technical guidance.
No, it is stayed in interim guidance. It's never been final.
Okay. The next question or comment is going to come in from Honolulu, and this is a statement, and I'll just ask the speakers to respond to this statement. They state SU composites can't be homogenized. They have to be subsampled in the same manner as an MIS, ISM, ICS sample in the lab to form a bulk ICS sample.
Okay.
That agreement? No?
No origin?
No?
No.
Okay. Excellent. The next question is coming in from Phoenix, Arizona, and they ask, historically, discrete samples were associated with core or grab samples. What is your definition of a discrete sample?
You want me to take a stab at that, Dina?
Sure.
Maybe your definition is different, so you can override me. But, you know, in my world, a discrete sample is a sample that comes from one physical location. As soon as you combine, and here let's use soil as a specific sample, as soon as you combine soils from two separate locations, physically separated, it's no longer a discrete sample. That would be a very basic definition.
Okay, great. It's 4 o'clock now. I'm going to continue to go on with a few more questions. We're going to go a little bit past our scheduled end time, but again, whatever we don't answer today, I will pass on to our presenters and ask that they work to communicate answers to you later on. So you can continue to type up your questions, but we may not get to them live. The next question is coming in, and we're going to take a question that is coming in from Denver, Colorado, and they ask, will the mechanics of calculating an exposure point concentration using ICS results for use in human health risk assessment be covered later in the webinar. And their understanding is the concern in using ICS results in an HHRA was not whether or not it was allowable in the guidance, rather how to generate the exposure point from an exposure point concentration.
Well, the exposure point concentration, as we saw from the risk assessment guidance, is considered to be the conservative estimate of the average. And so that's what an upper confidence limit or a UCL is. So yes, and you can calculate a UCL from incremental data using those replicates.
Can I add to that though, Dina? But the assumption is that you have more than one ICS sample from a decision unit on which to base that. As a matter of fact, you would need at least three. So if you only have one, well, then obviously you have a problem because you can't, or it's difficult then to assign a 95% UCL on a single value without understanding something about the underlying distribution from which it came.
Okay. The next question I'm going to take is coming in from Portland, Oregon, and they ask, what is your opinion of collecting replicates that include some of the same increments in more than one of the replicates? And, for example, 50 increments split into three 30-increment replicates.
No. No, that's not how replicates are done. They need to be independent. That means that different increments, different locations. Bob, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, well, sure. You know, if you were to do what was proposed, you would see variability in the result that came back, but that variability would only reflect the variability introduced by laboratory sample prep and analytics. It would not represent the variability that's present on the ground from the decision you're collecting your samples from. And that hopefully will have convinced you that that's where the most significant variability exists, and that's the variability you want to try to get a handle on, which is why when you're taking replicates, you want them from different locations because otherwise you're not going to capture the heterogeneity that's present at the site.
Okay. Our next question is coming in in reference to slide number 102, and they ask, do you have an opinion on using oven drying when sampling for diesel range hydrocarbons?
I don't think you'd probably want to do it because you'd lose the more volatile components. But I'm not an expert on diesel range or hydrocarbons.
We have another question coming in from Oregon, and they say, we've heard based on Chuck Ramsey's training that it is preferable to have one MIS sample made up of 50 or more increments than three replicates made up of less increments. What's your opinion?
Well, the goal is, what are you trying to do? If you need to calculate a UCL, you need replicates. If you take three replicates of 30 increments each, you've got 90 increments, which is a lot of increments for an area that might be as small as a quarter of an acre. So you have as many increments, they're just split into different samples, and they're independent increments. Do you have anything to say, Bob?
No, I guess I'm not sure what the advantage would be to having just one single incremental sample from 50 increments as opposed to, say, two or three, each composed of 30, because you're gaining information. Obviously, you're incurring additional analytical expense if you're doing more than one analysis. But you're also getting the kinds of information Dina's talking about. If that information's not important to you, then perhaps a 50-increment sample would be just fine. I guess it boils down to what in the end you're trying to get from your data.
Okay. I'm going to go through, I think, one more question, maybe two more, depending on how the speakers are feeling. The next question is coming in reference to the diagram on slide number 67. And they ask, with regard to the diagram on slide 67, with only 8 increments of each SU sample, how statistically defensible are the subsequent cleanup decisions made for each SU? Presumably there is less statistical confidence than a decision unit with 30-plus increments. Is EPA prepared to accept remedy decisions with reduced statistical defensibility in this context?
Well, the point of this is that the statistical decision was made on the decision unit using a UCL. Did the decision unit fail, or was it okay? If it failed, then you would analyze the SU samples, which are composed of the 8 increments. And at that point, you don't need statistical defensibility for cleanup. You already know that your decision unit fails and it needs to be cleaned up. You just need to know where. Bob, do you have anything to add?
The thing I would add is, you know, confidence is a relative thing. If you look at that diagram, you've got 8 times 4, 32 samples for a decision unit as a whole. If you think about how cleanups are typically done and decisions are made, think, for example, for a residential lead program, how many samples, discrete samples are typically allocated to a car? Not very many, okay? So is 8 samples per SU going to give you as much confidence as 30? No. Is it going to give you more confidence if there are only 2? Yeah. So how much confidence do you need in that particular SU that you're making the right decision? I mean, as Dina pointed out, sort of the real heavy decision is being made across the DU. Does the DU need to be remediated or not? The SU information is simply trying to facilitate more careful delineation of actually what has to come out of the DU.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. It is now 4:07. We do have a number of questions that are still in the queue, but in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and stop the live question answering right now. I will pass on those electronic questions to our presenters. Some of them are pretty detailed in terms of the number of samples and how would you defend it and what were the assumptions you made when you came up with this. So I'll pass those along to both Bob and Dina to answer offline. I'm going to ask everyone if you can move on to the final slide in the presentation materials that we had, which is slide number, if I scroll all the way down, 110. And on slide number 110, you'll find 2 links. One is to the additional resources or links page, which Dina was referencing throughout today's presentation. There were a number of guidance documents that she did have links for, and all of those links can be found on the links page. The other URL or link you'll find on slide number 110 is a link to our short feedback form. It takes just a minute or two to fill that out, and we would greatly appreciate your input on today's session. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today, if you fill out the feedback form, you'll have a box you can check to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. We don't necessarily hand out CEUs or PDHs here on CLUIN, but those of you participating may find that your accrediting institution will accept a copy of your slides and a copy of that confirmation email to give you credit for participating today. I also wanted to point out that, again, this was part one of a 4-part seminar series, so the next module in this session will be delivered on February 21st at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and that module is going to cover a number of items, including incremental averaging to improve estimates of the concentration mean, composite searching to improve hotspot detection, and limitations, caveats, and quality control relevant to ICF. And we'll have the very same presenters today joining us for that next module. If you were part of the group that had audio difficulties earlier, again, we were able to capture a complete recording with no audio disruptions, and we're going to make that a top priority to get that recording out. Hopefully in a day or so you'll have an email and be able to replay whatever you missed, and we should not have these difficulties. We've isolated what the problem was, and that will not happen for the future deliveries. I'm going to do my best to make sure we don't see this again. So I apologize again for any difficulties that you may have had when you were streaming audio, but I appreciate everyone hanging in there. Those are the end of the official reminders. If you are looking at a printed copy or not actually at a computer with internet access right now, all of the links and feedback forms and copies of the presentations can be found on the seminar homepage, and those things will continue to remain available after this session ends today. So if you can't fill it out now, you can certainly go back to that anytime you like in the future and provide your feedback. So with that, I want to extend my thanks to the over 400 individuals who joined us from all over the world. We had an international audience today. It was quite exciting. I want to thank both of our presenters, again, Dina Crumbling here from EPA and Bob Johnson from Argonne National Laboratory, for taking the time to put this session together and delivering a lot of information in a very efficient manner. I appreciate everybody's time and energy today. So again, I hope that you will, if you haven't done so already, register for part two, which will take place on the 21st of February, and that I will continue to hear from you all on our next session. Thank you all so very much for joining us, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. This is the formal conclusion for today's Internet seminar.